Welcome, curious minds, to another profound deep dive.
Great to be here.
Today, we're peeling back the layers on a topic that sits right at the very heart of our national security. Yet it's, while it's persistently shrouded in myth, the true landscape of cyber threats,
it really is.
We're going to challenge a pervasive, almost comforting illusion and instead reveal a far more complex, often surprising, and frankly, alarming world of state-sponsored cyber actors and other non-traditional players.
Yeah, the reality is quite different from the pop culture image.
Before we plunge in, just a quick word about who we are. This is the Security Nexus Deep Dive, brought to you directly by the Security Nexus.
That's us.
We're a Maryland-based national security consultancy, and our core mission really revolves around strategic advisory, education, and public engagement.
We try to bridge the gap between the technical and the strategic.
Exactly. We navigate the intricate, ever-changing landscape of cyber threats, hybrid warfare, and strategic security policy. Through platforms just like this deep dive, alongside our blog, specialized training programs, and direct consulting, we strive to provide clear, accessible, and importantly, actionable knowledge.
Making it understandable and useful is key.
Our ultimate goal is simple: to inform, to educate, and to empower both professionals and the wider public. If you're seeking more in-depth resources or further insights, I really encourage you to visit us anytime at thesecuritynexus.net.
Lots of good stuff there.
Now, for today's mission, we're setting the record straight on major cyber incidents, moving beyond that simplistic idea of the lone wolf hacker.
Yeah, that lone figure in the dark room.
Right. Our conversation today is built upon some truly foundational and, I think, illuminating research. We'll be drawing extensively from Bart Sherman and his colleagues' 2017 paper, aptly titled End of the Lone Wolf, The Typology That Should Not Have Been.
A really seminal piece in that area.
We'll also be dissecting Clay Canfield's compelling 2022 article, The Illogic of Plausible Deniability, and weaving in insights from Johan Sigholm's 2016 work on non-state actors in cyberspace operations.
Canfield's work really challenges some long-held assumptions, and Sigholm gives a great framework.
And adding even more texture, we have the brilliant research by Alexandra Palicka, Mitras Choresh, and Marek Palicki, particularly their 2021 piece, The Stray Sheep of Cyberspace, a.k.a. The Actors Who Claim They Break the Law for the Greater Good.
Which sounds intriguing just from the title.
Doesn't it? And also their earlier 2020 paper, Cyberspace Threats, Not Only Hackers and Criminals.
Broadening the scope beyond the usual suspects.
We'll also examine cutting-edge work on proactively identifying emerging hacker threats from Sagar Samtani, Honggi Zhu, and Hinshin Chen's 2020 paper.
Looking ahead, which is crucial.
Plus, we'll gain crucial insights on advanced persistent threats from the comprehensive design and evaluation of advanced persistent threat scenarios for cyber ranges paper, and round out our understanding with keen analysis on information warfare from The Politics of Uncertainty, Cyber Operations and Information Warfare in the Digital Age, a critical paper where Clay Canfield is also a lead author on related impactful work.
So a really solid base of research to draw on today.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Let's unpack this. Imagine this. A major cyber incident hits the headlines. Perhaps a prominent bank crippled, a critical government network breached, or maybe even sensitive national secrets exposed.
Happens all too often.
Almost instinctively, our minds jump to that shadowy figure we've all seen in movies and TV shows. The lone genius hacker, hunched over a keyboard in a dimly lit room, fueled by code and energy drinks, operating entirely on their own.
The classic Hollywood hacker.
It's a powerful, almost romanticized image, right? Deeply ingrained in our pop culture, and even alarmingly in how we construct policy and national security narratives. It's a bit like the lone wolf terrorist narrative, isn't it?
Very much so. That idea of the isolated individual.
This idea of a self-radicalized, completely isolated individual acting alone without any external connection or guidance. But what if I told you that image is largely a dangerous illusion, a myth that profoundly distorts our understanding of national security?
That's precisely the core of our discussion today. What's truly fascinating and often overlooked is how that popular image, while incredibly compelling to our imaginations, so significantly misses the reality on the ground.
How so?
Well, as Bart Sherman and his colleagues laid out in their 2017 paper, End of the Lone Wolf, rigorous research, particularly in the realm of terrorism studies, has pretty much debunked the entire notion of truly isolated lone wolves.
Really? Debunked?
Largely, yes. These individuals, who might appear to be self-radicalized and acting entirely independently, almost invariably have some form of ties, maybe weak ones, digital or fleeting, but ties nonetheless to larger radical groups or broader ideological milieus.
So they're not truly alone.
Rarely. They're rarely as solitary as they appear. The idea of a truly isolated actor, free from any external influence, is largely a fallacy, according to the research.
So if that's true in the terrorism space, where individual radicalization often seems so personal, how does that apply to the cyber realm? Are we really seeing a similar pattern with these seemingly rogue hackers, or is it different because the skills are so technical?
It's not just a similar pattern. It's arguably an even more pronounced one. And it's complicated by a very deliberate disinformation loop at play in cyber conflict.
A disinformation loop? What do you mean?
Well, the rogue hacker narrative is incredibly politically convenient, almost indispensable, really. It serves as a remarkably effective smokescreen for state involvement.
How does that work?
Think about it. If an attack can be convincingly attributed to just some independent hacker or a criminal group, it becomes extraordinarily difficult to legally attribute that action back to a specific state.
Ah, I see. It muddies the waters.
Exactly. This, in turn, complicates efforts to hold that state accountable and diffuses any potential strategic retaliation from the victim.
Yeah.
If you can simply shrug and say, oh, that was just some rogue individual.
Yeah.
Governments can sidestep significant diplomatic fallout, avoid accusations of state-sponsored aggression.
And avoid escalation.
Crucially, yes. Prevent the escalation of tensions that might otherwise lead to a full-blown international crisis or even military action. It provides a layer of plausible deniability that benefits the sponsoring state tremendously by minimizing direct consequences.
Okay, that immediately raises a critical question for me, and I imagine for many of our listeners. If it's not just these isolated, shadowy, lone hackers operating independently, then what is truly happening behind the scenes of some of these major, impactful cyber incidents we hear about in the news almost daily? Who are the real players, and what does their complex landscape actually look like beyond the headlines?
That's where the picture gets exponentially more complex and, frankly, much more concerning for national security. As Alexandra Paulika, Mika Chorius, and Marek Policki thoroughly detailed in their 2020 work.
The Not Only Hackers and Criminals paper.
That's the one. The collection of cyber threat actors is far larger, far more nuanced, and significantly more varied than just your typical criminals or the simple one-dimensional hackers we often imagine.
Okay.
These actors possess an incredibly diverse range of motives, their scopes of action vary wildly, and they wield tools of vastly different sophistication levels. And right at the very top of that hierarchy in terms of capability and impact, we find what we refer to as nation-state actors.
Nation-state actors. Okay, tell us about them.
These are, without a doubt, the most sophisticated and potent threat actors operating in cyberspace today. Think of them not as individual hackers, but as the elite cyber soldiers and agents of governments.
Like a formal military unit, almost.
In effect, yes. They operate with truly staggering budgets, dedicated resources, unparalleled capabilities, and access to highly skilled personnel recruited from national intelligence agencies, military units, even top academic institutions.
Wow.
And their support isn't merely financial. It extends to receiving direct strategic direction from their government entities.
So they're not just incredibly well-funded, they're operating under a direct strategic mandate, like a military unit.
Precisely. Their operations are not ad hoc. They are meticulously planned, state-sanctioned campaigns aligned with national objectives. Their primary goal is often multifaceted. Steal sensitive data, invaluable intelligence, national secrets from other nations.
Espionage, basically.
Yes, but beyond espionage, they're frequently tasked with disrupting other nations' critical infrastructure, interfering with political processes, or directly influencing international relations through cyber means. The incidents they orchestrate carry significant international weight and can profoundly impact geopolitical stability.
And they're patient, you mentioned.
Incredibly calculated and patient. Unlike the swift, often noisy, smash-and-grab operations we might associate with some cyber criminals looking for quick monetary gain, nation-state actors play the long game.
The long game.
They deploy sophisticated tactics that grant them quiet, persistent access to target systems and networks, often remaining completely undetected for months or even years, meticulously collecting data over extended periods.
Years, wow.
Their objective is long-term intelligence gathering and strategic advantage, not immediate disruption. They have no immediate need for a quick in and out. They are there to establish a persistent presence.
And crucially, they can carry out these operations with virtually complete impunity within their own borders, can't they? There's no legal deterrent for them at home.
It's a critical and often chilling point. Because their actions are directly supported, tacitly or overtly, by their state, They operate without any fear of legal retribution in their home countries. Highly unlikely they'd ever be arrested and prosecuted.
So they're protected.
Essentially, yes. These groups are generally linked directly to a nation's military, its primary intelligence agencies, or other state control apparatus. Sometimes, individuals within these highly specialized units are even selected not just for their technical prowess, but for very specific non-technical skills.
Like what?
Such as language proficiency, deep social media savvy, or intricate cultural knowledge, which are crucial for engaging in sophisticated propaganda, espionage, or disinformation campaigns.
Ah, so it's not just coding.
Not at all. What's more, they are often the pioneers, the first to introduce truly novel tactics, cutting-edge insights, and unprecedented attack vectors that are later copied, adapted, and adopted by other malicious actors globally.
So they're setting the trends in a way.
They are essentially setting the curriculum for future cyber threats.
That's a sobering thought that they're not just executing attacks, but essentially innovating and setting new global standards for cyber warfare. What are some of the specific methods these incredibly powerful actors employ? Beyond just general hacking, what does their sophisticated toolkit look like in practice?
Their methodologies are exceptionally varied and continuously evolve, but some core approaches stand out. A primary one is the use of Advanced Persistent Threats, or APTs.
APTs, heard that term a lot.
Right. Now, don't let the technical term intimidate you. Think of an APT as a highly sophisticated, continuous, and clandestine hacking operation designed to gain and maintain access to a system over a prolonged period, often without it being detected.
Like a digital spy living inside the network.
That's a good analogy. It's like a highly skilled burglar who doesn't just break in and grab something quickly. They install hidden cameras, set up listening devices, establish permanent secret tunnels for future access.
Wow.
For instance, the infamous Shady RAOA APT campaign, attributed to a nation-state actor, went completely undetected for up to 2 years after the initial infection.
2 years?
Yes, allowing for extensive data collection from multiple high-value targets before its discovery. Other well-known APTs like Stuxnet, which targeted industrial control systems, or Fancy Bear, known for political espionage, illustrate their diverse goals and profound impact.
So beyond these super stealthy APTs?
Beyond the purely technical, they heavily leverage social engineering.
The human element.
Exactly. Manipulating people to reveal confidential information or perform actions they wouldn't normally. They do this by targeting vulnerable or high-profile individuals with meticulously crafted spear phishing emails. These aren't your general spam, but highly personalized, believable messages designed to trick them.
Tricky.
Very. Another insidious method they employ is called poisoning the well, where they compromise or create strategic, seemingly legitimate websites to surreptitiously spread malicious software to unsuspecting visitors.
So just visiting a website could infect you?
Potentially, yes. Effectively snaring victims who simply browse these sites. They might also soften up targets by creating sophisticated, spoof social media profiles to build trust, gather intelligence, or even recruit insiders before launching a direct technical attack. The human element is often their weakest link, and they exploit it masterfully.
It really emphasizes how much more than just raw technical skill is involved. It's psychological warfare as much as cyber warfare.
Absolutely.
And with all the sophistication, it's no wonder NATO, for example, has formally recognized cyberspace as a fifth domain of operations alongside land, sea, air, and space.
A huge recognition.
That really signals a profound shift, doesn't it? That nations are increasingly prepared to wage war, or at least highly aggressive conflict, through the internet.
It absolutely does, and it underscores the true gravity and strategic importance of the situation. This brings us directly to the concept of cyber proxies, which is a key mechanism states use to conduct these operations while maintaining a critical degree of separation. Johan Sickholm highlighted this in his 2016 work.
Cyber proxy, so using others to do the dirty work.
Essentially, yes. Similar to how traditional proxy wars allowed states to fight without direct military confrontation, cyber proxies enable states to pursue strategic objectives without the immediate liabilities of direct, undeniable attribution. It's all about maintaining that critical distance, that plausible deniability.
And who are these proxies? Are they all the same?
Not at all. They aren't a monolithic group. They're incredibly diverse, reflecting a wide spectrum of capabilities, motives, and relationships with their state sponsors. They can range from established, highly organized criminal syndicates to individual freelance hackers operating independently but aligning with state goals, or even ideological volunteers motivated by a shared political or nationalistic agenda.
So a real mix.
A real mix. And the forms of state support they receive also vary significantly, reflecting different levels of control and deniability.
How so?
Well, Sehome outlines a few types. Some proxies are delegated, meaning they are fully funded, managed, and directly controlled by the state, almost like a covert branch. Others are merely sanctioned, operating with informal government approval, a nod and a wink, if you will, where the state provides tacit encouragement, resources, or simply turns a blind eye as long as they serve state interests.
Looking the other way.
Right. And then you have those that are fully orchestrated, essentially absorbed into official cyber units or intelligence agencies, becoming an integral, albeit often deniable, part of the state's cyber force.
So who are the main players actively leveraging these cyber proxies on the global stage? Which nations are most frequently associated with these operations?
Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea are consistently cited as the most active and prolific sponsors of these cyber proxies. Their state-backed groups are responsible for a significant percentage of the high-profile cyber espionage, disruption, and influence operations we see globally.
The usual suspects, some might say.
Frequently, yes. However, it's profoundly important to note that this isn't solely the domain of authoritarian or adversarial regimes. Even democratic states have, at times, engaged in what's effectively cyber outsourcing or the use of proxies, albeit often in a more limited or targeted fashion.
Really? Democratic states, too?
There have been credible allegations, for example, of Israel and the U.S. providing technological and other forms of assistance to groups like the Awaz hackers who have specifically targeted Iran. Now, these are allegations, but they highlight the point.
Right.
This demonstrates that the strategic utility of proxies, the ability to achieve objectives while maintaining a degree of separation and deniability, isn't lost on any nation looking to project power or achieve geopolitical aims in cyberspace. The gray areas of international law and attribution make proxies an appealing option across the board.
That's a crucial point, that it's not just one type of state. It really makes you wonder, if this is all about avoiding direct blame and managing international fallout, how effective is that strategy really in today's increasingly interconnected and surveilled digital world? Let's dive into the core reasons states use proxies, the logic of plausible deniability. Can you unpack that concept for us? What does it truly mean in this context, and is it still working?
The logic of plausible deniability, as Clay Canfield meticulously explores in his 2022 article, is essentially a strategic cushion, a meticulously constructed legal and diplomatic buffer.
A buffer, okay.
It's explicitly designed to allow a state to disavow operations that, despite being tied to its orbit or interests, can't be irrefutably proven to be directed by it. The idea is to create just enough ambiguity, just enough distance, that a government can credibly deny direct involvement without immediately being called out by the international community.
Keeping their hands clean, officially.
Precisely. This tactic serves multiple intertwined interests. Domestically, it can prevent public outcry or political damage. Internationally, it helps avoid diplomatic fallout, circumvent direct legal obligations under international law, and crucially, maintain escalation thresholds. If an attack can't be definitively attributed, it becomes significantly harder for the victim state to justify a severe response, kinetic, or even a robust retaliatory cyber response.
Yeah.
It's about controlling the narrative and minimizing the cost of aggressive actions.
So it's about managing risk and maintaining options. But you mentioned Canfield's paper is called The Illogic of Plausible Deniability. Is this strategy still effective in today's increasingly transparent digital world, or is it becoming, as the title suggests, illogic?
It's rapidly becoming a double-edged sword, to use Canfield's very apt description, and its utility is diminishing. We are seeing a significant, measurable shift where the traditional advantages of plausible deniability are eroding.
Why is that?
One major reason is the rapid and continuous advancement in forensic attribution. The tools and techniques for identifying indicators of compromise, or IOCs, those digital breadcrumbs attackers leave behind.
Like IP addresses, malware signatures.
Exactly. Analyzing unique malware signatures, understanding the distinct tactics, techniques, and procedures, or TTPs essentially, an attacker's unique playbook, or modus operandi, have become incredibly sophisticated. Cybersecurity firms, intelligence agencies, even academic researchers can now reconstruct attack chains with remarkable precision.
Making it harder to hide.
Far harder for states to truly obfuscate their digital fingerprints. The digital forensics teams are increasingly able to connect the dots, even through multiple layers of proxies.
What else is changing?
Furthermore, victims are growing bolder and more assertive. They're increasingly willing to publicly name culprits, even based on strong circumstantial evidence, rather than waiting for irrefutable, ironclad proof that might never materialize.
Naming and shaming, basically.
Exactly. This leads to significant political and reputational blowback for the accused state, regardless of formal legal attribution in a court of law. As Cormack and Aldrich, cited by Canfill, argue, even in its supposed heyday, the concept of plausible deniability was deeply problematic.
Even back then.
Yes. Today, they contend, we live in an era of implausible deniability. The lines are blurring to such an extent that strong suspicion, publicly voiced by a victim state, can be just as damaging as definitive proof.
And there's also the inherent risk of relying on external actors, isn't there? The proxies themselves can become a problem, creating unforeseen consequences.
Exactly. This is the classic principal-agent risk, often referred to as the Promethean dilemma.
The Promethean dilemma sounds serious.
It is. It's the inherent danger when a state delegates its dirty work to external, less controllable entities. When a state relies on proxies, it inherently risks those hackers going rogue, perhaps exceeding their specific mandates and launching attacks that are too aggressive, or even exposing the state's involvement unintentionally.
Like losing control of your weapon.
Precisely. They might pursue their own agendas that misalign with the state's broader strategic goals, or their actions might inadvertently reveal state secrets or capabilities. For example, a proxy might target a non-approved entity, leading to a diplomatic crisis the state wished to avoid. Or, through careless operational security, they might expose details of the state's intelligence apparatus.
So it can backfire badly.
It's a constant tightrope walk for the sponsoring state. The more a state empowers and enables a proxy, the greater the potential for unforeseen and damaging consequences.
And do we have actual evidence that the strategy is declining?
We do. And we don't just rely on theoretical risks. We have empirical evidence. Canfill's 2022 analysis of various comprehensive datasets, like Valeriano's Dyadic Cyber Incident Dataset, the Council on Foreign Relations Cyber Operations Tracker, and Okoto's Cyber Proxy Onset Data, show some truly compelling trends.
Okay, what did he find?
While overall cyber incidents have continued to increase, particularly aggressive Russian and Chinese espionage, the rate of new proxy relationship states forming new partnerships with external groups actually flagged quite significantly after 2010.
Fewer new proxy groups being formed.
Correct. This suggests that states might be moving away from establishing new proxy relationships as a preferred or viable method for deniable operations. They're finding it less effective for achieving the deniability they seek.
So we're actually seeing fewer new proxy groups emerging, even as overall cyber activity rises. That's a significant shift in strategy.
It is, and it points to a broader change. Even more tellingly, Canfill's research indicates that robust U.S. public responses, like public indictments or direct blame attribution.
When the U.S. calls them out publicly.
Yes. That's positively associated with other countries' increased propensity to use their own operatives, or to insource these operations in subsequent periods.
So public blaming makes them bring it in-house.
It seems that way. In other words, when the U.S. publicly names and blames a state for an attack, that state appears to shift away from using proxies and increasingly toward conducting operations directly with their own government personnel. The deniability benefit simply isn't worth the public relations cost anymore.
Interesting. And the U.S. has been doing more of this public blaming.
Absolutely. The U.S. Department of Justice has certainly demonstrated a growing willingness to cast blame. They've significantly increased indictments of foreign hackers, explicitly attributing their actions to specific nations, even if those individuals are unlikely to ever face trial in a U.S. court.
Like those Chinese PLA officers.
Exactly. The indictment of 5 Chinese PLA officers in 2014 for economic espionage, or the 30 individuals indicted for the massive Equifax Act in 2017. As former Acting Deputy Attorney General John Carlin stated, proxies are not immune from the law. While direct prosecution is difficult, the public naming itself serves a powerful purpose. It strips away the cloak of deniability and imposes a reputational cost.
So the legal shield is weakening.
Considerably. To summarize this critical point, the burden of proof in international relations concerning cyber attacks is increasingly being decided, in practice, by the victim state. If a state is willing to make allegations based on strong suspicion and robust forensic evidence, rather than needing absolutely irrefutable court of law level hard evidence,
which is hard to get anyway,
exactly, then the traditional advantages of plausible deniability diminish considerably. As Carlin succinctly puts it, complicity is in the eye of the beholder. The political consequences of being linked to an attack, even indirectly, are becoming too high to justify the strategies as it once was. This is forcing a strategic recalculation.
That brings us full circle to our starting point, the problematic lone hacker narrative. It seems this myth doesn't just distort our perception, it fundamentally distorts policy, creating a dangerous strategic blind spot when it comes to defending against these complex threats.
That's precisely right, and it's a crucial misconception to overcome. Similar to what we discussed with terrorism, the idea of a truly isolated lone operator in cyber operations is largely a persistent myth that needs to be retired.
So the Polica research backs this up too.
Yes, research by Polica, Chorish, and Polaki, 2021, clearly demonstrates that these so-called lone actors almost always have some form of digital or interpersonal connections to networks, even if those connections are loose, fleeting, or ideological, rather than direct command and control.
So their loneness isn't really a choice.
Often not a deliberate, strategic, operational choice. Instead, it's frequently the result of underlying social failures, mental health issues that make them unsuitable for group dynamics, or even a rejection from more organized group efforts due to their unpredictability or lack of discipline. They are not typically masterminds operating completely autonomously.
Okay.
What's even more critical to understand is that many seemingly independent cyber actors are in fact ideologically aligned with state interests, even if they don't receive direct orders or funding.
Like patriotic hackers.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Take prominent examples like China's infamous Red Hacker Alliance, a loose collective of patriotic Chinese hackers, or Russia's Cyberprkut, a Ukrainian hacktivist group with strong pro-Russian leanings.
Right.
These groups might appear to operate independently, driven by their own nationalistic or ideological fervor, but their activities often directly and sometimes inadvertently advance state goals. Mm-hmm. Their operational freedom, paradoxically, is actually a feature for states, not a bug.
How is it a feature?
It enhances the state's plausible deniability. It allows them to achieve their strategic objectives without leaving official fingerprints. It's a very clever way of having your cake and eating it too, at least for a period, as the state benefits from the disruption or intelligence gained while being able to disavow direct involvement.
That's fascinating. So beyond these state-sponsored entities and their ideologically aligned proxies, what other unusual cyber actors are out there shaping the threat landscape? We've heard a lot in the news about hacktivists and internet trolls. How do they fit into this complex, often murky ecosystem, and what makes them different?
It's absolutely crucial to understand these other actors as they contribute significantly to the overall noise, complexity, and unique threats in cyberspace. Mm-hmm. Let's delve into hacktivists first, drawing again from Polica, Chorish, and Polaki, 2021.
Hacktivists, okay.
Their roots trace back to the early days of the internet, congregating on Usenet groups and online message boards. Many of these early hackers were driven by a strong sense of idealism, often embracing left-wing, anti-capitalist, and anti-corporate viewpoints, combined with a definite sense of anarchic mischief.
For the lulz, as they say.
Sometimes, yes. This early spirit spurred numerous hacks protesting social and political issues, setting the stage for what we see today.
So what defines modern hacktivism?
Today, hacktivism involves individuals and groups intentionally using hacking techniques to bring about political or social change. They effectively merge traditional political activism with the internet as their primary medium, viewing cyberspace as a boundless platform for protest, promoting ideologies, or advancing political agendas often, it must be noted, through illegal means.
So motivation isn't money, it's cause-driven.
Almost never financial profit. Instead, it's a deeply felt burning rage for a cause. Whether it's to embarrass celebrities, highlight human rights abuses, challenge corporations, or disrupt entities whose ideologies they find disagreeable, their actions are driven by conviction. While they're almost always anonymous.
They like the spotlight, though.
Paradoxically, yes.
Yeah.
They crave collective recognition and publicity, frequently sharing stolen data, confidential documents, or proof of their exploits on public social media platforms like Facebook or Twitter to maximize impact.
And their methods, how sophisticated are they typically? Are we talking about highly advanced cyber warfare or something else?
Generally, their methods are, let's say, more basic, often lacking the originality or profound sophistication of nation-state actors. They tend to use widely available tools and techniques that require relatively little technical skill, which kind of democratizes access to disruptive capabilities.
What are some common methods?
Common methods include denial of service, DDoS attacks, specifically distributed denial of service, DDoS attacks. This is their bread and butter.
flooding websites with traffic.
Exactly. They gain control of large numbers of compromised computers, botnets, often through malware spam campaigns, and use these networks to flood a target website or server with overwhelming traffic. This can crash websites, denying access, and often sticking the owner with huge hosting bills. It's the digital equivalent of a massive sit-in.
What else?
They also frequently engage in information theft, leaks, and doxing. Illegally obtaining sensitive or classified data, and then publicly exposing it to embarrassed targets, or, as they claim, in the name of free speech or transparency. Doxing, specifically, is publicizing private identifying information, DOB, addresses, phone numbers, photos, to intimidate or harass opponents. We've seen law enforcement and government employees doxed, potentially putting them in real danger.
That crosses the line for many.
It does. Another prevalent tactic is website defacements, illicitly changing the visual appearance of a site, often called political graffiti online. More seriously, it can involve corrupting systems or skewing online polls. For instance, before the 2016 U.S. election, reports indicated 19 million bot accounts were deployed to send tweets designed to manipulate public opinion.
19 million!
And then there are virtual sit-ins, where activists repeatedly access a website simultaneously to slow it down or crash it, a digital form of civil disobedience, though generally less impactful now than botnet-driven DDoS attacks.
Can you give us some notable, perhaps iconic, examples of hacktivist groups or individuals that really define this space and illustrate their impact?
Certainly. Anonymous is perhaps the most well-known and arguably the most influential. Started as a collective name for anonymous users on 4chan, initially doing trolling campaigns for the lulz.
For fun, yeah.
Anonymous is unique. Faceless, amorphous, made of multiple proxy organizations and affiliated hackers, making them incredibly difficult to pinpoint or neutralize.
What about individuals?
Then you have the profoundly significant case of Edward Snowden and WikiLeaks. Snowden leaked thousands of classified NSA documents revealing extensive surveillance programs. WikiLeaks published them, sparked a furious global debate about whether these illegal actions were justified for the greater good, pitting security against transparency and privacy.
A huge debate.
Absolutely. Another group, LulzSec, combined lulz and security, gained notoriety for attacks on Fox.com, PBS, Nintendo, Sony PlayStation Network in 2011. Their stated intention was less political, more to gain attention, embarrass website owners, and ridicule security measures.
More about the mischief.
Seemed like it. We've also seen groups like Worms Against Nuclear Killers, who released malware into NASA's network protesting a nuclear rocket launch, reportedly causing $500,000 in losses. And on a different side, the Muslim hacking collective D53 and Shiro N challenged ISIS Dash, exposing subscriber emails and taking their site offline, highlighting the varied motivations.
That's quite a range of motivations and targets. But even with what might be perceived as noble causes, hacktivism is still illegal, which immediately raises a lot of complex ethical and legal questions, doesn't it?
It absolutely does, and it's a huge point of ongoing controversy. The cyber attacks are objectively illegal, yet some segments of the public, even some commentators, actually applaud these vigilante hackers, mm-hmm. believing they're exposing injustice.
The ends justifying the means.
That's the core of the debate. It often boils down to whether you sympathize with their cause. Mm-hmm. As Dan Lorman, a cybersecurity expert, said, there is an evolving definition of right and wrong regarding hacking. Some might think Snowden's actions were illegal, but the information was valuable for public discussion. It's complex moral calculus.
Where does it get really problematic?
The dynamic shifts significantly when hacktivist actions move from targeting institutions to targeting individual, regular people through doxing or harassment. Mm. What might be intended as protest can quickly become severe personal harassment, putting individuals and families at risk.
And it's evolving.
Furthermore, hacktivism itself is changing, moving from amateur actions to more heavy-duty politicized attacks. Worryingly, we're even seeing elements of hacktivism being co-opted or castily carried out by nation states, further blurring the lines and making attribution incredibly difficult.
Okay, let's shift gears slightly. What about internet trolls? They seem ubiquitous now.
Yes, another group to understand. The concept of trolling has been around, but its definition and impact have evolved significantly. Older definitions focused on something relatively benign, stirring up discussions mostly for fun and amusement.
Just being annoying online.
Basically. However, newer, more accurate definitions increasingly emphasize the direct emotional harm, the disruptive, and crucially, the deceptive nature of these actions. It's become much more serious, insidious, and potentially dangerous.
And a relatively recent subgroup, political trolls, really stands out, doesn't it? Their intent seems far more malicious than just stirring the pot for fun.
Yes, absolutely. Political trolls are a recent and particularly problematic subgroup whose sole explicit purpose is to sow conflict, deception, and distrust within the political system itself. They are actively working to undermine legitimate discourse and create chaos.
How do they operate?
They can be broken down. We have political bots, automated accounts spreading spam, harmful links, or amplifying messages at scale. We have organized trolls engaging in deliberate hate and persecution campaigns, targeting individuals or groups. And then there are those spreading fake news and disinformation.
Any high-profile examples?
We've seen notorious cases. Before the 2016 U.S. elections, thousands of troll accounts injected false tweets and fake news, aiming to create discord and influence voters. Forensically traced back to Russia, allegedly funded by the Internet Research Agency.
The IRA.
Right. Russian trolls were also active in Australia between 2015 and 2017, undermining government support for the MH17 response. And it's not just external actors. In Poland in 2019, the Deputy Justice Minister resigned after allegedly arranging a hate campaign to discredit judges critical of government reforms, planting rumors online.
Wow, even within governments.
It highlights how pervasive and sophisticated political trolling has become, blurring lines between domestic politics and cyber warfare.
What drives these political trolls? Is it just simple malice, or is there a more complex psychological profile or motivation behind their actions?
Their motivations are varied. Some studies link trolling to everyday sadism, a need for attention, low self-confidence, lack of empathy, or a desire to build online status through hate speech.
So psychological factors.
Often, yes.
Yeah.
Online anonymity provides a shield. Other research suggests some are just regular users mimicking aggressive behavior they see online. Importantly, studies often find political trolls are predominantly male and lack effective empathy, struggling to understand others' feelings.
I may just justify it.
What's particularly striking is that internet trolls often rationalize their behavior. They downplay consequences, minimize blame, and often feel their harmful actions are justified, perhaps believing they're fighting for a truth or cause, however twisted.
So it's increasingly clear that the threat landscape extends far beyond traditional hacking or espionage. This broadened, interconnected landscape leads us to a much larger and more profound concept. Information warfare, or IW, and influence operations in the digital age. How do all these diverse cyber operations fit into that much bigger strategic picture?
This is where we truly begin to see the systemic subversion of traditional democratic functions, creating what one source describes as unprecedented uncertainty about the nature and scope of the threat. Cyber operations aren't just incidental. They act as a potent adjunct modifier for IW.
An adjunct modifier? What does that mean?
It means they significantly enhance and amplify the effectiveness of broader information campaigns. This can involve securing private, damaging information illicitly, diverting public attention, compromising counterintelligence, and even acting as tacit coercive signals to implicitly threaten or manipulate society. It's about fundamentally manipulating the information environment itself, changing how people think, what they believe, how they act.
So when we talk about something like election hacking, it's often profoundly misunderstood.
Very much so. It's typically not primarily about directly altering votes in a ballot box or changing numbers on a machine. Instead, it's about something far more insidious. Hacking democratic electorates.
Hacking the voters, not the vote.
Precisely. Influencing public opinion, eroding trust in institutions, and actively muting the inoculating effect of democratic moderation mechanisms, those natural processes that help citizens discern truth, temper extremism, and engage in constructive debate. The goal is to poison the well of public discourse.
That's a powerful and disturbing distinction. So how does this relate to something as fundamental to democratic discourse as the marketplace of ideas? What are the critical requirements for that marketplace to function effectively, and how are they being attacked?
The marketplace of ideas, MOI, is a foundational metaphor. Different ideas compete freely, and through rational debate, truth ideally emerges and informs public opinion. For this to work, there are several critical requirements, and these are precisely what information warfare targets.
Okay, what are they?
First, the origination of information must be reasonably clear. Citizens should know where information comes from. Interlocutors shouldn't hide their identity entirely. Sources should be observable. Spin is okay, but obscuring origins is not. If you can't tell who is saying what, the marketplace is compromised.
Knowing the source matters.
Critically. Second, there needs to be credibility of discourse. Populations must believe the public discussion is genuine, not a facade. Contrast this with Russia's efforts to diminish democratic credibility or China's censorship, creating an artificial conversation with astroturfing and disinformation. When citizens stop believing in the integrity of the discussion, the system breaks down.
Trust in the process itself.
Exactly. Third, sufficient quality of information to distinguish signal from noise. Enough accurate, verifiable, diverse information must be available. If the environment is flooded with junk, truth can't rise.
Overcoming the noise.
And finally, a consensus belief in freedom of information. Citizens must feel free to use any fact or argument without fear of predetermined penalty. If certain opinions are effectively suppressed, the marketplace is stifled. We saw this historically, like before the 2003 Iraq War, where countervailing voices were muted by fear of backlash.
That's an incredibly clear framework. Let's apply it to a concrete example. The Russian interference in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. How does that complex case study illustrate all these principles of information warfare and the critical role of cyber operations?
The 2016 U.S. election is arguably the quintessential case study in modern digital IW, showcasing how cyber ops intertwine with influence campaigns. It wasn't sudden. It began as early as 2015 with thousands of sophisticated phishing emails targeting political operatives, campaign staff, government employees trying to collect private information.
The initial breach.
Right. Two prominent Russian groups, Cozy Duke and Fancy Campies, bare-linked forensically to Russia's GRU and SVR intelligence services, successfully stole a massive trove of emails and documents from the DNC and Hillary Clinton's campaign chairman. That was the critical intelligence gathering phase.
Then came the release.
What followed was a meticulously orchestrated, multi-channel campaign of information release. Russia's Internet Research Agency, or IRA, tied closely to the Kremlin, used thousands of bot accounts on Twitter and Reddit to gradually release snippets. Concurrently, WikiLeaks acted as a public amplifier, sponsoring larger data dumps, often strategically timed for maximum disruption. Other fabricated personas, like DC Leaks and Guccifer 2.0, were also used, designed to appear as independent whistleblowers.
And this multi-pronged approach was designed specifically to hide the true source, right? To create that plausible deniability.
Exactly. The strategic release through these various seemingly disparate channels, WikiLeaks for certain communities, DC's Guccifer 2.0 as whistleblowers, was crucial in masking the true origins. Made it incredibly difficult for average citizens, even media outlets, to pinpoint who was behind it, created widespread uncertainty and distrust.
And the platforms themselves played a role.
Profoundly critical here is the often overlooked role of algorithmic manipulation. Social media platforms acted as non-neutral forces. Their algorithmic design, Facebook's precise ad targeting, Twitter Reddit bots, amplifying narratives, enabled dangerous segregation into echo chambers.
Preventing people from seeing other views.
Actively preventing cross-perspective engagement. This further masked information origins, amplified targeted rhetoric, and made the environment highly susceptible to manipulation.
What about doxing?
Cyber operations also played a major role in strategic redistribution and doxing. Instrumental in obtaining and then systematically publishing private, often embarrassing information from organizations like Open Society Foundations and the DCCC-DMC. Weaponizing private data for public shaming and political leverage was key.
And the timing was deliberate.
The temporal nature was meticulously planned. The IRA timed doxing and info releases to maximize media effects and directed trolls bots to make democratic updating and cross-sectional discourse difficult. A prime example, WikiLeaks releasing DNC emails right before the Democratic National Convention.
To overshadow Clinton's nomination.
Precisely. Calculated timing to overshadow her nomination and fuel an existing scandal around Bernie Sanders' candidacy, diverting media attention and creating party division, effectively hijacking the news cycle.
So they were essentially faking discourse and actively muddying the waters, making it impossible to separate fact from fiction.
Precisely. The content pushed by trolls and bots often included intricate narrative spin and outright fabricated information. Cynical posts like, if you want Jesus to win, targeting evangelicals, narratives about Clinton and Libya for veterans, deep state accusations after DNC leaks, all designed to erode credibility and quality of public discourse, making it hard to trust any information. A systematic attack on informed public opinion.
How did the system cope?
The sheer novelty created a kind of systemic trauma for the democratic process. Unlike, say, 2003, in 2016, media attention was fragmented, focused on candidates, amplifying their authority. Republican lawmakers hesitant to challenge Trump's rhetoric, President Obama faced a forced paralysis due to the threat's novelty and fear of partisan backlash or escalating conflict. Traditional democratic mechanisms were hampered.
The Trump factor.
Undeniable. While Trump's rhetoric was unique, Russian efforts, particularly IRA amplification via social media and bots, massively magnified his voice, helped create alternative political realities for segments of the electorate. Research suggests this insidious amplification could have subtly but powerfully shifted voter preferences in crucial swing states.
So, summing up the 2016 example.
To conclude on this point, the true novelty of IW in the digital age stems significantly from the design of internet media platforms, coupled with citizens' limited ability to attribute and validate information in real time. This creates Byzantine failures in our marketplaces of ideas breakdowns where truth is obscured and everything feels untrustworthy. Cyber operations are a formidable force multiplier for IW, providing sensitive info, spreading malware like face music to inflate content visibility, acting as tacit coercive signals to degrade democratic systems' credibility.
Given this incredibly dynamic, increasingly sophisticated, and pervasive threat landscape, the obvious urgent question becomes, how do cybersecurity experts, or really any organization, possibly stay ahead of these constantly evolving threats? How do they proactively identify what's coming next rather than just reacting?
That's precisely the critical challenge professionals grapple with daily, demanding a significant paradigm shift from traditional reactive cyber threat intelligence, CTI, to more proactive approaches, as Samtani, Zhu, and Chen outlined in their 2020 paper.
The one on proactive identification.
Yes. Existing CTI often analyzes past network events. You're always playing catch-up. The real need is to proactively examine emerging threats within the vast, evolving international online hacker community. And within that, specific platforms like hacker forums are proving particularly useful.
Why forums specifically?
Unlike darknet marketplaces with more illicit goods, hacker forums are where hackers freely share and discuss attack threats, vulnerabilities, novel techniques, an invaluable source of raw, cutting-edge intelligence.
So these forums are a goldmine of information, a real peek into the minds of threat actors. But I imagine analyzing hundreds of thousands of unstructured text records from them with rapidly evolving terminology must be incredibly challenging. It sounds like trying to find a needle in a digital haystack that's constantly shifting.
Yeah. It absolutely is. You've hit the core problem. Enormous volume of unstructured text. Hacker skill sets constantly improving, new malware daily, existing threats evolving, and the pervasive problem of confusing semantics. Injection could mean SQL, memory, or process injection. These nuanced shifts make traditional text analytics largely ineffective. They can't grasp the evolving context.
So how do we solve that?
This is precisely why Samtani, Zhu, and Chen developed the Diachronic Graph Embedding Framework, or DGEF.
DGEF, okay.
It's a truly novel approach using what they call a graph of words, or GoW, representation of hacker forum text. Imagine mapping every word and how they connect like a giant spiderweb showing relationships between terms. That's the GoW. Its core purpose is generating word embeddings, unsupervised, learning complex relationships without needing pre-labeled data.
Learning on its own.
Right. But the truly game-changing innovation is its use of semantic displacement measures, borrowing from diachronic linguistics.
Diachronic linguistics.
Yeah. Basically, the scientific study of how language changes over time, how words gain new meanings, old meanings fade. DGEF doesn't just read forums. It watches how their slang and technical jargon evolve. This identifies subtle semantic shifts, giving cybersecurity pros a crystal ball into future threats by tracking the shifting meaning of a single word. It's incredibly productive.
That's incredibly powerful and sounds almost like science fiction. So how does this DGEF framework provide practical, actionable utility for cybersecurity professionals across the different levels of intelligence, from strategic planning down to tactical incident response?
DGEF offers value across all three critical levels. Strategic, operational, and tactical, fundamentally transforming proactive defense.
Let's start with strategic.
At the strategic intelligence level, DGEF supports quarterly reporting of emerging threat trends by constructing time spells, like splitting data into three-month intervals. The text graph visualizations offer strikingly intuitive visuals, invaluable for guiding executive-level security investments. For instance, if it shows a significant increase in DOS threats targeting Windows systems, maybe indicating a new exploit.
You can prepare for it.
Exactly. DGEF allows an organization to proactively allocate resources, bolster specific defenses, update architecture to mitigate those anticipated attacks before they become widespread, moving from reactive to predictive investment.
Okay, what about operational?
At the operational intelligence level, DGEF aids directly in threat hunting. understanding attack details, planning remediation. Its dynamic visualizations help SOC analysts prioritize, bypassing overwhelming raw data to focus on relevant threats. The unsupervised embedding allows dynamic threat representation without needing prior knowledge, adapting to rapid changes. And top-degree statistics, how central threat term is in discussions, help prioritize the most significant evolving threats, streamlining response. That's a real-time heat map of hacker priorities.
And finally, tactical, on the front lines.
Finally, and critically, for tactical intelligence, DGEF assists significantly in monitoring, escalating, detecting indicators of compromise, IOCs, those unique digital fingerprints. The computation of top-degree stats and, most powerfully, identifying semantic shifts provides invaluable tactical leads.
Can you give that corrupt example again?
Sure. Let's take that concrete example from their research, the term corrupt in DOS threat postings. In 2012, corrupt might have mostly pertained to attacking real player on Windows XP. Old news now. By 2016, its semantic meaning shifted, used mainly in discussions targeting Cisco WebEx player vulnerabilities. Then, by 2019, right before Windows 7 end of life, corrupt focused almost exclusively on attacking the memory of Windows 7 systems.
So that semantic shift would immediately tell you, hey, forget real player. We need to prioritize remediation and defense for Windows 7 memory exploits. That's hugely valuable for frontline defenders.
Exactly. That shift provides crucial, actionable tactical intelligence. Tells teams which legacy systems to prioritize patching, where to deploy specific detection rules. In the future, this nuanced intelligence can integrate directly into SIEM systems, those central security dashboards.
Automating the detection?
Potentially. New rules could automatically monitor for these shifted terms in file names, logs, generating immediate targeted alerts. This moves cybersecurity from just responding after breaches to truly anticipating and preventing them by understanding the evolving subtle language of attackers. It's a proactive defense revolution.
What an incredible deep dive this has been. We've journeyed from debunking the pervasive myth of the isolated lone wolf hacker to understanding the intricate, often alarming, web of state-sponsored proxies, ideologically driven activists, and insidious political trolls.
It's a complex web indeed.
We've seen how the once logic of plausible deniability is increasingly becoming illogic, and how information itself has been weaponized into a potent tool in broader influence operations, fundamentally reshaping the very foundation of democratic discourse.
What's truly fascinating and deeply important for all of us is that the cyber landscape is far from static. It's not a fixed battlefield. It's a dynamic, constantly evolving ecosystem where motives are complex, layered, and methods perpetually adapt, pushing boundaries.
Always changing.
The critical takeaway is the paramount importance of understanding this diverse array of actors and their ever-evolving tactics, not just focusing solely on the technical aspects. It's about knowing who you're fighting and how they think.
This raises an important, even provocative, final question for you, our listener. In an increasingly interconnected world, where the lines between state and non-state actors blur and shift, and where information itself is weaponized, how will our societies adapt their defenses?
A crucial question.
And I'm not just talking technically with new tools like DGEF, but crucially in how we as individuals consume and trust information. What responsibility do we as citizens in this new digital battlefield bear in discerning truth from calculated manipulation in our daily lives?
Something for everyone to think about.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the Security Nexus Beyond the Lone Wolf. Remember to visit thesecuritynexus.net for more insights and resources on navigating the evolving and complex landscape of cyber threats.
Keep learning.
Until next time, stay curious, stay informed, and stay secure.